Recording.
All right. Brian's going to record also.
I am recording.
Yeah, you are, big guy.
Yeah.
Well, that's going at the beginning of the show.
Yeah, it is.
I'd have a nightmare about that.
From Buffalo, from Seattle, from California, and from Birmingham in the UK, we present Bobbins in 60 Seconds. First episode. No, this is Bad Bobbins.
Wow, that's a lot of Bobbins.
35. I have been attempting to instruct my American colleagues not to say the word Bobbins because they don't understand how it works. But yes, nonetheless, we have Jeremy Garcia, Brian Lunduk, Jono Bacon, and I'm Stuart Langridge. This is episode 35 of Bad Voltage. What are we talking about this time?
Well, we are, of course, talking about Mir and Wayland, because we're a nerdy Linux-y type show, and so we talk about Mir and Wayland.
We'll also interview Alon Rabinovitz, who is one of the co-founders of Scale, which is the Southern California Area Linux Expo, the same expo in which a couple weeks we'll be doing Live Voltage.
Jeremy is going to do a review of essentially a hipster's boil-in-the-bag curry machine called the Anova Sous Vide.
That's harsh. That no, man. It's nice, this thing.
Langridge.
Oh, I'm next. Yes, I am. I'm actually next. I completely skipped over the bit on the list that was actually me. Yes, so Brian is, for the first time ever, correct in 60 seconds.
That's absolutely true. And then we're going to be talking about the upcoming Live Voltage event, which will be happening at Scale.
Yes.
And now, Bad Voltage.
On the 20th of February of this fine year, 2015, at 9 p.m. in Los Angeles, California, four idiots will convene in a room at the SoCal Linux Expo to record a Live Voltage.
Hell right? Yes, yes, we will.
Gonna be, yes, we
it's
will.
It's going to be
very
freaking
first live show.
Magnificent.
Possibly the very last.
Very first time. Wait. Actually, the first time we've been in a building together. Like, I've never met Brian before, no. Like face to face.
I never
Well, that's not bizarre, actually true. Oh, dear Mr. Jono, did you,
have
there was
before?
that one, before an OzCon, there was an Ubuntu conference, probably back in 2007, 2008, where we did meet.
Ubuntu Live.
We just didn't give a crap about each other, so we walked past each other, but we did, meet. We saw each other, you said, hi, and I believe I said something like, hey. It was very contentious and weird, but we kept going.
That is an epic meeting.
Yeah,
right.
And now it's recorded for all posterity.
It's nice. It's nice to see that your relationship has moved on so far since then. Oh no, wait, no, it hasn't at all.
Yeah, I thought I'd never met Jono either, and someone reminded me that I was in fact there, right there next to you, and you were right there next to me. So I had to be reminded
just looking,
too.
Just like drinking coffee, looking in opposite directions,
yeah, not giving a crap at
the same
all.
So, all right, if gotcha. You would like to see their first actual epic meeting, right, live on stage on the 20th, it's going to be brilliant. This is at Scale, the Southern California Linux Expo, as Elam was talking about. And if you're going, then you can get there. If you're going and you haven't already bought a ticket, then you can use the promo code that we've got, which is BVOLT, B-V-O-L-T, and that gets you 50% off the price of a ticket, which is only like $70 to begin with.
Right.
But still, it's gonna saves you $35, which is a whole crap ton of hamburgers, which is a good idea to have.
There is an In-N-Out close to the hotel, too, so you could buy those hamburgers right away.
Oh,
yeah. Zach?
One thing that we should be clear on as well is, like, this is, you know, this is going to be a live taping, our first live taping in front of an audience, and we you know, it's not often you sit in front of an audience and record an episode of Bad Voltage. It's happened precisely zero times in the past. The idea here is that we've made a real show of it. Like, so we've got a bunch of surprises in there. It's going to be a very audience participatory show. So this is, you know, it's not just going to be like, you know, a couple of discussion segments and a review. We're actually going to have a ton of really interesting stuff in there as well to make the most of being in a room with an audience. So a lot of you folks who are going to be there, you can participate. We're not going to tell you the way in which you're going to participate, but it's going to be a lot of fun. There's also going to be some giveaways as well, which is very important to make. Like System 76, who is sponsoring the show, brilliant people that they are, not only are you going to sponsor the show, but they're also going to be giving away a System 76 Galago Ultra Pro laptop in the show as well. Yeah, which is badass.
And that is. Thanks a lot to System 76 for that, obviously.
Yes.
Yeah.
Totally.
They're just such a fucking cool company in every sense of the word. So
as I thank you, there may be other things to give away as well, which is going to be rather cool.
Yeah.
But
I was going to say, we've been planning for this quite a bit. Just to give you guys an idea how high the bar is set, the time slot that we are filling last year was filled by Lawrence Lessig. So we have made sure to plan accordingly and go as balls to the wall as possible. So
that's what it's all about.
So please show up.
The co-hosts have requested that Brian, me, take my pants off. So if that tells you how high we're aiming here,
that is actually not entirely untrue, which is terrifying in and of itself.
But also,
reach for the moon.
When you no, we're not reaching for any of Brian's moon. Not interested in that. the point made earlier about people showing up, it's going to be busy, I think.
Yeah,
I mean, we might be terribly wrong here, but get there early because it might be standing room only.
Get there early.
It's possible.
Hopefully. Well, it was last year. If I get there and it's just Jono's mom sitting in the middle of an empty bunch of chairs, I'm going to be upset.
That's my boy.
Not me. Yeah, the thing I'm excited about taking off my pants and doing a show for Jono's mom.
On the other hand, Jono's mom's really cool, so that'd exists. Be fine. but yeah, the other thing
I used her as an example.
Because the UK is a bit too far away for people to get to scale, Joe Borg is putting together a Bad Voltage meetup in the UK, here in Birmingham, actually, in the Wellington on the 21st of February. So there's going to be a live stream of the show, yes, correct?
Yes, there will be. Yep. It'll be streamed live. Yep.
They're all getting together in the Wellington on the 21st from 11 a.m. in order to watch the live stream. So if you're in the UK, I wish you were at Live Voltage, you can be the next best thing.
Yeah. And what was I going to say?
Something awesome. You know,
we're probably not actually. Okay, well, that went out my head. But yeah, it's going to be brilliant. it's amazing.
It's going to be 90 minutes of that right there.
So definitely come and check it out. Yeah. Oh, that's what I was going to say. The other thing as well is for those of you who can't show up to scale because, you know, you don't live in LA, which is essentially a pathetic excuse, by the way,
or you can't show up Dubai, man.
Yeah, people coming from all over the place. Mm-hmm. Or you can't go to Birmingham to the UK Live Voltage meetup. Or you can't watch the stream. We're going to be recording the show as well on video and audio. So the show that will come out the week after scale is probably going to come out a few days, a little bit later. But it will be a fully video edited kind of extravaganza. So everyone will get to see
what's
going on.
That's going to change our schedule a bit because the show after this one would have come out on the 19th, which would be the Thursday, the same as our normal release. It'll actually probably be, it could be anything up to a week late, the Tuesday, Wednesday of the next week or so, because we want to put together the live show as a real thing. So prepare yourself for the fact that it won't be out quite then, but you'll be able to listen to the live stream if you can, or listen to the actual show the following week if you can't.
Yeah, absolutely. Ah, oh, man, I can't wait. It's going to be awesome.
It really is going to be awesome.
It's going to be great. And, you know, we're going to have some giveaways there. So definitely show up and get some of that and, you know, win some prizes, hopefully. And yeah, anything else that we are forgetting to tell these people?
No,
I think we covered it. It's basically the opposite of Bobbins. It's going to be awesome.
It'll be fantastic.
And you get to see Brian Lunduk's bare ass as well.
They keep trying to get me to do this. I haven't actually said, yes, I'm going to take off my pants, everybody. But all three of them have asked me repeatedly, so we'll see what happens.
Moon's over my lawn.
And you're going to sing. And of course, you're going to sing Baby It's Cold Outside as well, right?
Yeah, whatever happened to that?
Not singing, but I do like the Denny's joke that Jeremy just made, so I'm happy.
As I mentioned in my Soylent review, viewing gastronomy as merely about sustenance is anathema to me. To say I enjoy food, food culture, and eating is a prodigious understatement. It may come as no surprise, then, that I also enjoy cooking. While I've wanted a sous vide for some time now, there simply hasn't been an affordable model I liked until a recent round of product launches. The Innova Precision Cooker seemed like a nice confluence of quality, price, and technology, and was the device that finally convinced me to plunge into the world of sous vide. For those unfamiliar with sous vide, it's a method of cooking food sealed in an airtight bag, in a water bath, for longer than normal cooking times, at an accurately regulated temperature much lower than normally used for cooking. The intention is to cook the item evenly, ensuring the inside is properly cooked without overcooking the outside, while also retaining moisture. The Innova Precision Cooker is an immersion circulator sous vide that has a temperature range of 77 to 210 degrees Fahrenheit, is accurate to a tenth of a degree, and can heat up to a 5-gallon tank for a maximum of 99 hours. While the unit is Bluetooth-enabled and can be controlled from a smartphone, at the time of this review, neither the iOS or Android official apps have been released. With the technical specifications out of the way, it's time to move on to using the device. You may be wondering, how easy is it to cook with the sous vide, and more importantly, how does the food actually taste? Operating the Innova is extremely simple. You fill a suitable container with water, plug the device in, scroll the large wheel to your desired temperature, and hit the start button. Once the water has reached the desired temperature, you place the vacuum-sealed food in and wait. One great thing about sous vide is experimenting with the time and temperature to create an end result that's ideal for you. And once you have those two variables dialed into your tastes, you can perfectly replicate the outcome over and over again. To give you an example, a steak cooked for roughly 90 minutes at 136 degrees Fahrenheit results in a Jeremy-approved medium rare. As for the taste, well, it's delicious. But there's science behind it all. At these lower temperatures, cell walls in the food do not burst. In the case of cooking meat, the tough collagen and connective tissues can be hydrolyzed into gelatin without heating the meat's proteins high enough that they denature to a degree that the texture toughens and the moisture is wrung out of the meat. Because of this, it's not uncommon to cook some cuts such as pork belly or spare ribs for up to 48 to 72 hours. Additionally, enclosed spices or ingredients added to the sealed bag transmit their flavor more intensely than during normal cooking. The end product truly is amazing. One downside to this process, however, is that the low temperatures used means no Maillard reaction, and that means no delicious char. And that has a negative impact on both texture and taste. Enter the Searzel. Invented at Booker & Dax, which is the food science lab arm of the Momofuku Empire, the Searzel is an attachment secured to the top of a blowtorch to create the perfect searing temperature without the noxious aromas that typically result when cooking with a blowtorch. By forcing the thin flame of the blowtorch through two layers of fine high temperature resistant wire mesh, it produces a consistent, evenly spread flame that provides a professional quality sear. The end result of a piece of steak cooked in the sous vide and then finished with the Searzel is one that will rival the finest steak you've ever had. So, what's the bad voltage verdict? At $179, the Innova Precision Cooker isn't outrageously priced in and of itself, but do keep in mind you'll also need a vacuum sealer, suitable container, and optionally a Searzel, although I should note that a cast iron pan also works quite well. The total all-in cost can be significant, especially if you opt for a chamber vacuum. With that said, if you consider yourself an epicurean who enjoys cooking and eating, I think you'll be highly impressed with what this combination puts on your dinner table.
I have to admit, I'd not heard of this sous vide thing before. It sounds quite interesting.
You know why you haven't heard of it? Because it's pretentious. That's why you haven't heard of it before.
Pretentious? So I would be shocked if you have not had, if you go out to eat at all to anything that isn't a McDonald's or a P.F. Chang's or something. You've definitely had sous vide food before. Most of the better restaurants in all parts of the world pretty much
right. Actually
use sous vides, from steakhouses to just, you know, regular restaurants.
They are kind of
probably
awesome.
Had it. You just didn't know that you've had it.
Yeah, I'm sure. How did you kind of get into this? Like, how did you learn about this?
So like I said, to say that I'm into food and food culture is a vast, vast understatement.
Well,
and,
you eat crickets, so that's obvious.
I will try anything twice, as they say. But I'd come across it a couple times just in random reading. And then there's a restaurant I really like in Buffalo called Martin Cook's that one was actually sitting on the counter. It's kind of one of those open restaurants where you sit almost in the kitchen. And so I was kind of talking to him about it, but the commercial ones are very expensive in the multi thousands of dollars. So the ones that are for home use and don't suck and are affordable are kind of a new thing in the last couple of years. And I think this one, the latest release, be it from Sincere or Anova or any of the newer ones, is really where they hit their stride, where they're highly usable and affordable.
Gotcha. I can see the value of using this technique. As you say, I mean, it produces really well-cooked food, and I'm all in favor of doing things that make food taste nice. But getting a piece of steak and then sealing it in a bag and then cooking it for 2 days and then blow-torching it afterwards seems like a massive pain in the ass by comparison with, you know, just frying it. Is it actually worth it?
So I think it is, but there's kind of a couple different things there. It sounds like more work than it is, actually. If you're just looking at something like a steak, I would say it takes maybe a minute to vacuum seal it once you're familiar with the vacuum sealer. I would say the sous vide takes maybe 90 seconds to set up. And then the cooking, obviously, it varies. Like a steak, and the one nice thing about the sous vide, right, is when you cook on, let's say, a stove, let's say you're doing a cast iron steak, the cast iron is significantly hotter than you want the steak. So timing is very important. The difference between 90 seconds and 200 seconds is huge. But even the difference between 90 seconds and 110 seconds might be the difference between burned and delicious. Where the sous vide, because you want the steak at 136 and the water never is 135 or 137, time is much less critical, right? So you can leave it in there for an hour minimum for a steak is what it takes to get to that temperature. But if you leave it in there for 2 hours or 3 hours or 4 hours, it really doesn't matter because it's never going above that temperature. So you can throw the steak in. You know, I work from home, so I just start the sous vide a little before I want to eat, and then 90 minutes later, I slit the bag, sear it really quick. So all in, I would say you're probably into that steak for maybe 10 minutes. And so cleanup is super easy, so you just wipe it off. So you're talking about something that tastes better, and in the end, is probably easier.
It's kind of like a crock pot, except for steaks.
Well, no, that's the thing is I use steaks as an example, but I mean, if you want to get a perfectly done soft-boiled egg, right, there's a science behind the time and the temperature to do that. And the other nice thing about it is if you have a really tough cut of meat, you can leave it in there for very long time. And like I said, because the collagen and stuff hydrolyzes, you're going to get really, really edible, moist results out of a cheap garbage cut of meat, be it pork, steak, be it anything.
It's the same basic principle as smoking, right? That, you know, you can take like a brisket, which is a really tough piece of meat, and if you stick it on at a low temperature for long enough, it will become really tender. The thing that this to me seems like a smoker is a pain in the ass to set up and run. It's dirty, it's messy, and all the rest of it. It seems to, you know, a smoker will go for a shorter period of time than this, but the benefit of a smoker, of course, is that you get that smoky taste in there. The thing that I don't quite get about this when it comes to steaks is there is no doubt that, you know, to cook a steak well on a grill is like you have to be borderline Jedi Knight to get that right, to get it tender and to get that searing on the edge. But it seems like this doesn't do the searing, but you could conceivably use this to get the meat tender and then just whack it on the grill for a minute, right? A really hot grill for a minute to get that searing.
So like I said, the Searzel is an awesome device to see in action. It really, I'll have to post a picture of it. The thing really is insane. And you can sear a steak. I do about 45 seconds aside. It depends how much of a crust you like on it. But you can throw it in just a regular cast iron pan for 30 seconds aside or so. I don't know that you'd want to throw it on an actual grill after that, but I mean, as I said in the review, if you don't get that Maillard reaction, I personally wouldn't like the taste of a steak without that. Some people do eat it without that, but I think that process, which is really just a non-enzymatic browning, it really makes all the difference for flavor wise. So you really, that's why it's kind of a two-part process. But I would say any upper end steakhouse, they're probably sous-viding most of your cuts.
You know, think that most steakhouses are? You wouldn't think that they're grilling them?
A lot of them don't say that they do, but they do, because it's a way that they can make hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of steaks at perfectly medium rare. Either, like you said, they have to have a Jedi that can cook that many steaks all at once on the same, you know, giant grill, or they sous vide all of them. You know, they have different containers. This one's medium rare, this one's medium, and then they just sear them at the end. Although, so it's a way for your, if you have a steakhouse where the steak's always coming out the same, they sous vide their steaks.
I do get the impression, though, that the sizzle is about, you've got it 10% because it's actually providing a really brilliant steak, and 90% because you think you're the Human Torch out of the Fantastic Four, right?
I mean, after I saw the video, I immediately was like, I have to get one of these. And I'm a huge David Chang fan. I'm a huge Momofuku fan. You know, Booker and Dax is in New York. It's just a really cool place. If you're ever in New York and you want a really cool drink, and they have small plates as well, food-wise, Booker and Dax is...
So this is basically a massive blowtorch, essentially.
Well, no, you still need a real blowtorch. So I have just a Burns-O-Matic regular blowtorch. But this
is just a big... I'm looking at pictures right now. I mean, it
looks like... So it just goes on, right? But
wait a minute, wait a minute, wait a minute. Is your blowtorch really a Burns-O-Matic? Is that a real thing?
Yeah, it's a brand name.
Is that a real brand name? A Burns-O-Matic? That's awesome.
But you could use any blowtorch. It doesn't matter. But the thing about a blowtorch is, right, it's really hot, really narrow flame, which is not good for finishing a giant, you know, especially if you're doing a large cut of porterhouse or something, where this has that flame be a very reliable depth and a very reliable heat over a larger surface area.
Who first thought, I mean, who first went, you know what I'm going to do? Instead of cooking a thing properly, I'm going to boil it in a bag and then I'm going to blowtorch it. Who came
instead
up with
of cooking
ideas?
A thing properly?
So the genesis behind the concept is actually a French guy that first thing that was cooked in there was foie gras. And because when you cook foie gras, you lose so much of it to that hot pan, and foie gras is so expensive. The first thing that, you know, the reason they came up with it was basically foie gras. And then from there, they realized that you could turn a bunch of rough cuts of pork and a bunch of rough cuts of a whole bunch of other things into very good, high quality things. So that, you know,
I think it's a neat idea. I think it's a really neat idea because, like I said earlier on, like a smoker is a big investment, takes a lot of time. But the idea that you could have something in your kitchen to cook, because, I mean, perfectly cooked brisket is just unbelievable. I mean, it's so good to eat. Yep. And this seems like a really nice kind of middle ground that you could, you know, to get that tenderness in there.
Brief technology question about it. You said that you can control it with Bluetooth, right? But there aren't any apps to do this. So how do you know?
So the two apps from Innova haven't been released yet. They're behind schedule, quite to the chagrin of most of the people in the Innova community, which is surprisingly large, which I wouldn't have thought. But there's a bunch of just generic iOS, and you have an iPhone, but I've downloaded an Android app called Celsius that generically controls a whole bunch of Bluetooth-enabled TVs, and that does work. It's an open thing. You don't need the Innova app. They claim that they're going to have built-in recipes and a whole bunch of other things and timers and stuff like that. But the generic app, which I think was like $1.99.
But this is an app fine. Which is basically designed so you don't have to bother walking across the room to press the on button. I mean, what else does it do?
You can also check the temperature and do a whole bunch of other things that seems completely bobbins, as you would say to me. The only thing I'll say is the interface on the device
is... say bobbins ever again. Never say that.
It sounds a bit weird when you say it, Jeremy.
The timer function is really weird on the actual device. You have to like hold the button down for 8 seconds and then stand only on your right foot and jump up and down and do all kinds of weird stuff. So the timer functionality is much easier in the app, and you can change the color of the scroll wheel. But as far as actual usefulness, if you cannot dial a wheel to a number and hit a button, I'm not sure. This might not be the device for you, I guess.
You know what? Honestly, so for $180, this doesn't seem bad.
No.
I mean...
No, and like I said, you're not going to cook everything in it, but it does make really good vegetables. And I've tried a whole bunch of different, you know, the one thing I had
cold.
Some interesting Cajun spices and sealed it into the chicken bag and then did it. And it really does... The flavor profile is really, really good. There's a good depth of flavor, and then you finish. It's just a really nice way. But I would definitely say it's not something you're going to use every day. It's more just one other thing in the toolkit that is,
This is cool. No, this is really,
kitchen.
Really cool.
When you stick that, using steak as an example, when you put it in the bag, should it be does it matter how tight that bag is? Like, is it okay to just stick it in a Ziploc bag? It seems like it's better to have it more
so
like vacuum
don't
sealed almost.
Technically need a vacuum sealer. You can, if you dip, so if you put something in a Ziploc bag, get a big thing of water and slowly submerge it so most of the air gets out and then seals it, you technically right. can sous vide. It won't, that air does actually make a big difference. But a cheap food saver sealer is maybe about $99. What you really want, if you want to get, you know, kind of badass with this, and I just didn't have the resources to put into it, but if you get a chamber vacuum, that will actually liquid seal in things, so you can say put barbecue sauce on something, or you could actually take a watermelon, put vodka in there and seal that. Obviously you wouldn't use the sous vide for that, but you could put vodka in or whatever liquid and then vacuum seal that until it steeps into the watermelon. But a good chamber, or not even a good, a cheap chamber vacuum is like over $800. But if you were to get serious about this, that's probably what you would want. I just,
Jono's saying that we have to wrap this up, but I have a very important question for you. Have you tried to cook hot dogs in this yet?
I have not,
but it does sound like an awesome idea, right?
Aren't most hot dogs pre-cooked?
Well, you got to make them warm though. And it's got to be right. I spent like $80 on a hot dog toaster. So I have in my kitchen where, you know, you cook hot dogs
and
a hot dog toaster.
Oh
yeah. Yeah. Those things are rad. But I got to say the sous vide, even though it's over twice as much, sounds slightly more versatile. So I'll definitely give you a thumbs up there.
You know what, dude, given the fact that you eat almost every time we record Bad Voltage and you talk about the food that you like to eat, I really genuinely fear for your colon. I don't know what it must be like down there. Oh, it must be like shitting bricks.
I have seen inside of it and it is squeaky clean, my friend. It is like polished marble in there.
Well, I have to say, I'm not positive
if that's good or bad.
If I'm having one of you cook for me and I'm not allowed Jono's wife to be the one I pick, then it's going to be Jeremy.
Fair. All right, so on the show now, we've got Ilan Rabinovich, who is one of the organizers of the very popular Southern California Expo in Los Angeles, also known as Scale. How you doing, Ilan?
Good. Thanks for having me on the show, guys.
That's obviously good to have you here. Now, Scale didn't come around like a lot of big conferences like LinuxCon, you know, Linux World, quite the opposite, with a bunch of people sat around a table with suits on. It started from the community. What's the history of it? How did you kick this thing off?
So Scale's been running for about 13 years now. It started off as an event actually called Lugfest down in LA, which was essentially a meta lug meeting. We had about 10 to 15 lugs in the LA area at the time. You probably couldn't walk a mile without running into an install fest.
Right.
And so we realized that none of the lugs were sort of meeting together. So it was essentially every 6 months or so we had a meta lug meeting. That was an event that was started by the Simi Valley lug. And that was Gareth and myself and Orb and a bunch of other Scale guys were involved there. About a year into that, after a couple years of that, what we realized was that, we lost our venue. We've been getting a space donated to us by Nortel, and it worked out.
Right.
It was working out pretty well, but .com, bubble burst and they essentially imploded. And we started looking for a place to have a venue. Around the same time, a couple other groups at UCLA and USC were also thinking about starting their own event. And so we got together. It's just a bunch of college kids and our friends from the local lugs got together and said, well, we want an event near us that has, has the speakers that we can't normally get at our lug meetings, folks that are normally up in the Bay Area or from other places. And, how do we get them, how do we get them to come talk to us about the things that we're interested in? Well, let's start a conference. And so it's just sort of started from there. I don't think any of us really had any sense of how much work would be involved or what the type of work would be. I mean, we're just all, I think I was a freshman in college at the time. I had no idea what I was doing.
Right.
And somehow it all just sort of worked out. We started meeting with folks from the various schools and from the various lugs. And, I guess, everybody just seemed very excited about it. And all of a sudden, apparently, after 13 years of doing it, it feels like I think we might sort of know what we're up to now, but,
it certainly seems so. It certainly seems so.
So it grew organically. So.
So this Scale is the 13th one. Yes.
Yes. Very, very, very lucky year.
Is Scale now the biggest conference around? The biggest Linux conference?
We think it's the largest community run open source conference in North America, at least. I think where FOSDEM sort of rivals us in terms of size. Over in Belgium, but it's a
FOSDEM feels less like a conference, more like just a bunch of homeless people showed up for a weekend. I mean, it's like it's like scale is like a form, like a thing, right? Yeah. FOSDEM is just like a bunch of people hanging out. It's like FOSDEM feels more like a festival to me than scale.
I haven't had the pleasure of attending. It's one I'd love to check out. It always lands about 2 weeks before scale when we're all running around with our hair on fire. I think it's a slightly different format, right? It's probably more like 10 or 15 conferences running at the same time that happen to be co-located, which is great. And we've tried to take some of that spirit and adapt it for scale. And if you look like at the Thursday and Friday parts of scale, they're mostly not run by the scale team. What we've done is reach out to various communities as well as our sponsors and say, hey, we've got an event here. Would you like to be part of it? What would you like to, do you have your own events you'd like to run? And so we have groups like OpenSUSE that's running a summit, a development summit at scale. We have the DevOps community is running their DevOps days. There's UbuCon from the Ubuntu community. So essentially, the first 2 days of scale are not, we're there to provide the infrastructure and to help the communities run their own events. But we're co-locating other folks, and a lot of that idea came from some of the conferences like FOSDEM that are essentially a bunch of smaller conferences mixed together.
Do you get the chance to go actually out to other conferences, or is so much of your conference time in life dedicated to scale that you just can't leave the Los Angeles basin ever?
So funny story. I think probably a good half of the team is no longer located in LA. So I'm up in the San Francisco Bay Area. There's a couple other folks from our team that have. I mean, it's no longer a LA focused show. It started that way, but now we've got folks coming from as far as Dubai this year. In terms of your actual question, though, we do attend other conferences. Some of us are involved with other conferences that we help plan as well. So I like to help out with the DevOps Days events in the Bay Area or the Texas Linux Fest out in Austin. We start planning for scale about the time the last scale ends.
Seems about right.
So it's about, actually this week we have some calls about 2016. So it is a year round planning event, but we do get out to other conferences to meet with folks. It's a good way to find out it's a good way to meet speakers we'd like to invite to scale, as well as just to learn how to make scale better.
And hey, can I just say that I really appreciate that you plan so far in advance to make sure that the Live Voltage event goes off well. I really appreciate you taking that year to do that.
It's touching, isn't it? A serious question there. Now that scale is this huge, big deal, you could obviously get big name headline speakers to come along and talk about things, real movers and shakers in the Linux world. Look at, Bacon, people like that. But
come on,
actual serious big names. But is there a risk that you're going to get captured by this kind of chase to get big name keynote speakers and not have ordinary people talking about ordinary things?
So we like to have a good mix of that. We have speakers in the LA area that are from the LA area that are local LUG members that are speaking. We had lots of folks speaking from businesses in the LA area as well, as well as from around the country. We try to do a good mix of professional, folks that are essentially doing the conference circuit as well as folks that are speaking at scale. It's definitely different than when we had the LUG Fest, right? The LUG Fest that we ran back 15 or so years ago in Simi Valley, those were mostly community members. It was LUG members that took their recent LUG presentations and repurposed them for this sort of meta LUG meeting that we had. So I think there's definitely a risk, but we try to avoid it. I mean, the same way that as we get more and more sponsors joining us at scale, we still try to keep the exhibit hall a 50-50 mix between open source projects and and commercial exhibitors, just because we think that gives the, we think that's what gives scale the energy that it has, is that strong mix of community in the commercial. In some cases there are booths that are, there are community and nonprofit booths that are, as you all know and can imagine, are a bigger draw than some of the commercial exhibits, and vice versa. And so they feed off each other's energy. We try to place them together in ways that where they'll be collaborative and complementary, rather than sort of fighting against each other for traffic or for the spotlight. And it works well. I think it makes for a more interesting and fun event.
Yeah, the Expo Hall of Scale definitely has a different feel than I think almost any other conference that I've been to. I know that.
Yeah, for sure.
I mean,
I was going to say a good example of scale, keeping it real and keeping it down to earth and not just being a place where big names spend their time, is the fact that Live Voltage is happening in scale. Elan, one of the things I was curious about is, you know, I think the closest that I've come to, and ACK as well, in terms of a community organized conference, was Lug Radio Live that we used to do. And you get to a point where it goes from being like a thing that you and your mates put on to being a bigger deal. And I think that invariably that's when you get your first like speaker that's like a real pull, like a real celebrity kind of thing. Which one of those 12 years do you feel like you hit that point where scale went from being just a thing that you and your mates did to really being like a proper thing where like big speakers would come and speak at?
I think probably around the fourth or fifth year is when we realized, it was no longer just a thing we were doing for fun.
Right.
I think probably at the second year is the last time almost any of us saw an actual session. I'm joking a little, but it was, it's funny. We started this whole thing because it was to get the sessions we wanted to see and to meet the speakers we wanted to meet. And in reality, what ended up happening is we put on a big party for all of you, for everybody else. And, you know, we don't actually get to sit and enjoy most of the sessions most of the time.
Yeah.
We always tell ourselves we'll go back and watch the video or listen to the audio. And, I think we have varying levels of success at that. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Fantastic. So what do you see the future of scale being? I mean, is it kind of just kind of do more and more of the same? Like, because it's been a fairly consistent in terms of format, I think. I mean, there's obviously there's the kind of mini conferences that happen on the Thursday and the Friday. But do you have any kind of like big ideas and plans that you guys want to move towards?
So the big change that's probably going to come in the next year or so is changing venues. We love the Hilton and we love working with the folks there. We've been there for about 4 years now. And it's always good to come back to the same venue over and over again. It makes a lot of the work easy. You know where there's network drops, you know who the staff, you know who to ask for help from, you know what the policies are, things like that. But we've just gotten to the point where we can't fit in the Hilton anymore. So we're starting to look around the LA area at other venues, and you know, hopefully we'll have some announcements about that at scale this year. That's cool. That's the big change that's coming. But otherwise, I mean, the way we try to change it up is we bring in other groups to focus on areas that we think are important or underrepresented as part of those Thursday and Friday events. So if you look at things like, this year, the ADA initiative is having their ally workshop at scale, or the SUSE mini summit, things like that, areas where we can bring a complementary community that's not maybe directly part of what we're doing at scale and help sort of, you know, get that message in front of the scale audience, as well as drawing that community to help diversify our attendance a bit. I think it's going to be more of that with new and interesting topics every year and new guests. It does, we try to do after a couple of years is see if we're running the same event year after year. Sometimes we try to see if it makes sense for it to stand off on its alone as an independent conference and try to bring in somebody else to fill in that. To fill in that spot and just keep things changing so that it doesn't become repetitive. But that's cool. Sort of our way to change things up is to add more events and to, around scale, as well as to just change the topic areas. You can really see how the industry is changing. The open source space is changing based on the proposals we get as our call for papers. I think 4 or 5 years ago, it was like 40 to 50% asterisk in VoIP talks. Over the last 2 years, it's been, you know, you see lots of cloud talks coming in, or OpenStack or CloudStack, things like that. So it just sort of, that's where you can see, that's where you see sort of, you see both scale adapting, but also a community adapting to what's interesting at the time.
That's awesome. Well, thank you, Elon, for coming on the show. Just so people are aware of it, Scale is going to be happening in Los Angeles at the Hilton at the airport. It's from the 19th to the 22nd of February. So in just a couple of weeks after we release this show. Yep. And do you want to maybe just give us a quick minute of like some of the top features of Scale, like maybe some of the keynotes and stuff like that, just to attract people to your show?
Sure. So we've got two great keynotes this year. Ruth Seeley from the Fedora community in Red Hat is going to be talking about the Maker community and how that and how it's the next frontier for open source. And then we also have Monty Taylor from HP and from OpenStack and generally all around good free software guy. with a session called Why Free Software is Still Important. There's some sessions from a number of the Bad Voltage presenters.
Hell yeah, there is.
Yeah.
Hell yeah. And by the way, I just want to commend your bravery to be putting on a session called Windows is Awesome at the Southern California Linux Expo. I just wanted to say that means that you have giant cojones and you're a good person.
Yes, that's Brian plugging his own talk there.
Is that what Brian, I was doing?
Brian never plugs himself.
Yeah, I never plug
incident.
Myself. That's true.
Never. Anyway, so there's a good 60 to 70 talks each day of the event at Scale. So, I mean, you multiply that out across 4 days, you're talking about, you know, 240 to 300 talks here that we're going to have. So I'd encourage everybody to check out the schedule on our website, socallinuxexpo.org. And then don't forget, if you're a Bad Voltage fan, you can use the promo code BVOLT to get 50% off your registration.
Yep. Perfect. Perfect. Thanks, Elon.
Thanks,
and we'll see you in a few weeks.
See you soon. Bad Voltage Live.
Wrong.
In 60 seconds.
For the next 60 seconds, I am going to tell you about the thing that I hate the most. The thing that brings me more anger, more angst, more pissed offiness than any other damned thing in this big, stupid, fart-filled world of ours. That thing? Writing this stupid segment. I can bitch and moan about damn near anything and everything all day long, but when I need to sit down and fill a measly 60 seconds with something I don't like, suddenly the world is made of nothing but roses and cotton goddamn candy. I can't think of a damn thing I hate. Just the stupid bird-brained idea for a segment. Wrong in 60 seconds. How can someone possibly fit a full rant into 1 minute? And that name makes me want to punch a puppy. Whose dumb freaking idea was this thing anyway? Probably Jono. Crap, I should have done this on Jono. Hey guys, I feel like it's been a really long time since we've talked about something controversial, but pointlessly controversial. Could we talk about Wayland and Mir for a minute? I feel like we just should do that. I actually don't have anything to say. I don't have any substance to supply this conversation about Wayland and Mir, but I feel like it's been so long since we've ranted about something Wayland or something Canonical's done that we have to talk about this.
Well, no one really talks about
Mir.
Say
something of the century, but
about
was,
Mir and Wayland for a bit. I mean, I guess System D is the new kind of ranty top point of conversation recently.
Yeah, so. But I feel like we've really given Leonard enough hell for, I don't know, at least a 6 month period. We got to give him like a couple weeks off to regenerate before we come at him again.
I'll tell you what, though. I bet you the Mir developers were on their knees giving thanks of that System D came along and took them off.
That's probably true.
Probably secretly their idea.
All right, so what's going on with it? I mean, I saw a post a few weeks ago from I tried to dig it up before we recorded. I couldn't find it, but there was a post from one of the GNOME development team, or maybe a Fedora person, saying that I think the next version of Fedora is going to ship a first cut of Wayland.
Kinda. So I talked to Matthew Miller on my new Puppet Talks to People show last week,
and what Mr. Lunduk.
Yeah,
is it required that you get one plug in per segment?
Seriously.
I really wasn't trying to plug. I was trying to think of a way to frame this without plugging myself, just because I didn't want to get crap for it.
And amazingly, you failed to find such.
I always do fail. So what the leader of the Fedora project told me, and I hope I'm remembering this right, is that the next version of Fedora will have kind of a first cut of it, but will not be default and may just simply be in the repository for an additional thing. And then sometime in the future, it's not even necessarily going to be the release after that or the release after that one, but sometime in the foreseeable next couple releases, it sounds like Fedora will actually ship Wayland. So that's that's the hope.
Ubuntu are taking, as I understand it, quite a similar route. You can now install what they call the Unity 8 desktop, and that's running on Mir. And at the moment, it's mostly in a PPA, but then it will become an option you can install yourself, and then eventually the desktop will migrate over to it. It's interesting. Ubuntu on phones is all Mir top to bottom right now. And Will Cook and people like that are doing a few mad demonstrations of saying, look, here is an X app running on the phone. Completely pointless, but it demonstrates the technology. But it sounds like
That's awesome.
No, it's technically awesome, absolutely. But running a desktop version of LibreOffice on a 4-inch screen doesn't actually work.
I have done it, and it's awesome.
Your opinion here is, frankly, not necessary.
Opinion here is, frankly, bobbins.
You're not allowed to say bobbins either. There are people out there who actually genuinely want this, who really want to run actual X apps on their
phone. Called me.
Those people are morons, but they want it, and that's fine. What's good is that the technology supports it. And that... As I understand it, the Jolophone is Wayland, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
Have they done similar work? Because obviously bringing Wayland to the desktop means that you'll be able to run X apps within it. I assume that that's one of the things that's going to happen. Have people used the Jolophone as a working Wayland thing to demonstrate that?
I don't know.
It's a good question.
I
mean,
I have to say... you know, I know, obviously, I'm a bit biased because I'm a Ubuntu guy, but I was quite impressed with just how quickly the Mir team managed to lash something together for the phone, because it's actually been pretty reliable on the phone. You know, it's been pretty good. I'm curious to see how quickly both of these things can actually go to being full-on production across these different platforms, because they're both basically doing the same thing, right? I mean, Mir is much more... Mir is easier because it's there to serve one use case, really, which is Ubuntu. Right. Wayland's got many more like ducks that have to be put into a row, but I'm quite impressed how Mir has spun up. What I'm less familiar with is how quickly Wayland's moving forward, but I know that there's a great team working on Wayland, for example, that's... Are you guys familiar with how quickly it's reaching maturity?
You know, honestly, I'm seeing a lot less about that lately. Because, I mean, 6 months or so ago, it was like we were seeing videos of here's how KDE is doing on Wayland and, you know, here's how GNOME is doing with Wayland. And we saw all these demo videos. But lately, I haven't heard a whole lot. I don't know. Have you guys heard much?
The impression I have with that is that they're now at the point when, you know, the concept is proven. You have GTK apps running on top of it, so on and so forth. The Yola people have proved that it's entirely possible to bring up an actual full environment on this. So now it's just a question of smashing down all the spiky edges until the thing actually becomes production ready. So that's quite boring It's great that it's happening, but it's not particularly exciting to be able to talk about it. You know, it's just a question of, oh, yeah, we have this thing when, we have bugs when you start Wayland and it runs out of RAM, then sometimes it crashes and we'll fix that. But it's not particularly showy. It's just, it's just a question of a long slog until it happens. I think it's fantastic. The way I think I see Mir and Wayland are, people are desperately trying to drum up controversy about it, you know, and pointing fingers at Canonical did this or Wayland does a different way. But they seem to me to be like GCK and Qt. Two things where ideally you'd only have one, but they made different technical decisions. And I'm sure there are Qt people who think half the GTK team's technical decisions are wrong and incorrect and shouldn't have been made in the first place. But we have them, so why is it a problem? And it's just never going to affect me.
And the thing is, as well, is, and one of the things I learned from being at Canonical is that what you see in the news and what is happening behind the scenes are two totally different things. Like, there is, you know, there is this misconception in the open source world that everything is out in the open, that everything's happening out in front of people. But in reality, it's not the case. There's a lot of politics. There's a lot of behind-the-scenes stuff that's going on. And it's bullshit on all sides. Like, no one's right about this. But what I'm curious to see is there's not been a lot of talk recently about driver support. I haven't heard from either camp much about whether graphics cards are going to actually be able to do any of this stuff. And that's a pretty major deal.
Well, I mean, Intel explicitly took the mindset that they're not going to support Mir, correct? They actually pulled Mir support out of their drivers explicitly and said they weren't going to re-add it as a matter of principle.
Yeah, that
was a while ago. Other than that, I haven't heard anything.
That's so baller. Like, I don't necessarily agree with it, but I gotta respect the extreme stance, you know? That's hardcore.
And that was, I believe that was more because of the CLA than the actual technology. It was because, you know, obviously Mir is under the CLA, the Canonical CLA.
Right.
And I think there was a...
Because it's like not real open source, right.
So... It is real open source. But do we know what's going on with both of them? I mean, I think the last thing I read from Canonical was that Ubuntu 15, it's either 15.04 or 15.10 will ship Mir by default.
No,
I think they bumped it to 16.04, right?
They were talking about 15.10 being the Unity 8 desktop, and... Every time I hear about it now, it's 16.04. Nobody's really talking about 15.10 anymore.
Well, that's right.
So you're still talking about 12 months from now before the Unity 8 desktop is the default. You can install it today on 14.10, which is the 15.04, which is the current in progress release, Vivid. You can install the Unity 8 desktop today, but it's explicitly there so you can install it and have a play with it, not to install it and use as your real desktop. But they're still doing things like, making windowed mode work rather than assuming that all apps are full screen like they are on the phone. But
it's craziness.
Yeah. But they always knew that needed doing for the desktop. And impressively, they went from this isn't done. They kept saying, we'll add the windowed stuff later because it's not that hard. And everyone's like, man, so you're betraying us. And then they went from not having it to having it in the space of like 2 weeks. So it actually clearly wasn't that difficult.
Yeah. It's amazing how quickly that came together again, knowing how much those teams are working on other stuff. Like, Ubuntu's trying to ship a phone, okay? There's a lot to do. Like,
they've got a phone to ship in the next 3 years. It's a lot of work.
I am picking up my phone building in 2 days.
Yes, indeed.
I'll believe it when I see it. So
we'll be picking up $50 from Brian Lundick as well, right? In a couple of days.
I'm looking forward to that. Right?
You know what's really weird, and this is more of a psychological thing, is both Wayland and Mir to me feel like they are kind of. You know, Duke Nukem levels of vaporware-y in that they've just been talked about for years. There was a couple of proposed, hey, at this point in time, it's going to ship by default on this distro or that. And those came and went, 2+ years back now in some cases. And it feels a little vaporware-y, but at the same time, I don't know what I'm actually waiting for either Mir or Wayland for. Like, once they do ship, my life actually doesn't change at all.
No,
but yet I'm looking at it, and I'm waiting for it, and I'm harping on it about it, and I'm like, well, why isn't those shipped yet? But they provide absolutely nothing new to me, near as I can tell. It's just like this weird psychological, like, feedback loop I'm stuck in.
Totally. I mean, certainly from Mir's point of view, I don't know as much about Wayland, but the Unity 8 desktop relies on Mir, but not particularly because it's critically important that it has Mir's way of interacting with the display. It's because then you can do things like install click apps and you can confine them, which you just flat can't do under X because it's really difficult to stop one app stealing another's keystrokes or whatever.
Yeah.
Right? And I assume Wayland provides the same level of isolation. But in practice, using the Unity 8 desktop, the fact that it happens to be using Mir to render textures to your graphics cards, whatever, man, don't care. It's just not important.
It's just not important.
But it has to be important at some level, right? Because if it wasn't important at all, why would Canonical West invest so much money and burn, to be honest, so much goodwill in doing so? So it's important at some level.
I think it is important. I mean, to Axe's point that Mir is important to Canonical from the perspective of convergence. It's one code base that can move forward. It was also important from Canonical's perspective in terms of being able to deliver the convergence story, because Wayland, frankly, is driven by a bunch of people that Canonical doesn't have a particularly fantastic relationship with, and Canonical wanted to do less, not more, in the Wayland code base. So the Canonical actually wanted the code to be removed.
I agree with that.
And that's the difficulty there. But then to Axe's point, there's like a huge set of security issues with X, and you can't build, like, so you couldn't build the Ubuntu phone and have the conventional Debian app and depackage package model for delivering apps because it's too slow. So therefore, we had to build something new. But to do that in an application isolated way, you can't depend on X.
Yeah,
I mean, and that's one of the reasons why. So it's this spidery set of legs of benefits. But to Brian's point, like, from a user's perspective, it's like, whatever.
So, exactly. I mean, it's entirely possible that the Mir team have made a bunch of technical decisions which aren't actually correct. I mean, people who work in this sphere a lot, people who I respect, you know, Dan Stone, that sort of people, have pointed at Mir and said, I believe that to be a wrong decision there, and they shouldn't have done that. And I find that sort of criticism much more relevant than the whole, oh, Canonical is doing their own thing and it's not invented here, because whatever, right?
Yeah, who gives
that's
a shit?
That's happened who with everything. If they want to do it, that's the way they do it. I'm an Ubuntu user, happy with it, whatever. But even if those technical decisions are wrong and they're bad for the long-term Linux ecosystem, the long-term Linux ecosystem isn't using Mir. And Ubuntu are obviously happy with it.
Well, at this point, yeah. I mean, Ubuntu is just so far from traditional, I mean, Linux distributions. It's just moving farther and farther all the time. It's just not really... Yeah. Linux anymore. It's
right. I was going to say
Linux, but it's not.
I think it's
like
part of the overall goal of Ubuntu just not being Linux in general. It being Ubuntu.
Yeah, that's the goal, and that's cool. It's cool.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I think acting like there. It's the convergence story is hiding what the. I don't think that's a bad goal. So I don't know why things seem to get conflated sometimes in the telling of the story.
I tell you what, though, going back to the point about the drivers, though, this worries me. I mean, I have no idea what's going on in the. I know there was a bunch of discussions between Canonical and the various driver manufacturers, the various hardware manufacturers,
AMD.
And those conversations were actually going reasonably well. I have no idea what's happened in the last probably six to eight months, and it really does worry me that if we don't have those drivers, like, the Linux desktop is going to be up shit creek without a paddle. So,
oh no, not the Linux desktop, just Ubuntu.
No, this affects Wayland as well. This is not just a Mir thing.
But we don't need Wayland. We've already established that. I mean, there's no new functionality for end users anyway. It basically what ends up happening is it doesn't hurt Linux at all. It just hurts Mir and Ubuntu and over here Wayland. And if all of those projects crumble, I still go on and use Arch and OpenSUSE or whatever I want with any other desktop.
It's going to affect KDE and GNOME. Both of those projects are moving over to Wayland.
Yes.
But they run just fine on X11 right now.
Right, but the point is that now. Yes.
Mm-hmm. They do right now, but they're moving away from X support to Wayland support.
If Wayland has driver problems, desktops just aren't going to be switching over to Wayland. They're going to stick with X11. KDE, GNOME, all of them are going to stick with it as well. And we as end users, power users, and developers are going to do just fine. It's projects are going to go into the trash bin. That's fine.
And I think that wraps up the very last show we're going to do before we all see each other live and in the flesh for the very first time in Los Angeles. Unless any of you guys have anything else to add.
Well, there may be actually, if we meet up in LA and then it turns out we all hate each other, there may be no more shows.
Just be the last show, full stop.
Very possible.
Distinct possibility, actually.
So I am hard to be around.
Everyone gets there. We're just so annoyed by Brian Con that we just
disband entirely.
Exactly. Right?
Lunduk broke them up. By the way, speaking of things, Mr. Lunduk, what the fuck is Mr. Lunduk all about? Like, you've done this puppet show, right?
My puppet show.
Yeah. Is it going well? I mean, it's going great. It's a little bit weird.
It sure is a little bit weird. I think the first video is up over 10,000 views now.
Nice.
And I've got interviews. Here's the thing, guys. No joke about this. So I am the worst puppeteer on the planet. I have no idea what I'm doing. So I shove my hand up this puppet's butt, right? And then I email people, hey, do you want to get interviewed by a puppet with my hand in its butt? Everyone, with two exceptions, has said, hell yes. So I've got interviews scheduled like crazy. I mean, everyone keeps having to reschedule half the time on me, but like people I wouldn't normally get. Two people, only two people have turned me down.
Oh, you gotta out them. Though?
And you know what? I'm gonna out them right now. The first one was Eric Raymond.
Stallman.
I had a nice chat with Eric Raymond. He does not want to do it because he does not want to be interviewed by a puppet because he feels like it's not serious enough.
If that puppet had an NRA card, I'm pretty sure he'd be fine with it.
Here's the thing. I think he's afraid that the puppet is going to make fun of him, which obviously the puppet is. So he's right about that. But
I think he's doing okay by himself, by the way. Anyway,
the other one, of course, was Richard Stallman. Richard Stallman said no, because he does not want his videos up on YouTube. He was down for the being interviewed by a puppet, but not if it was going to go up on YouTube. So
only if it was a puppet on a yak.
You should do it and just not put it up on YouTube for that one episode. Just so I would love to see, like, the thing that got me when I watched your interview with Matthew Miller, the Fedora project leader, is that I like Matthew Miller. He's a nice guy. He's a fairly awkward kind of person to begin with, right?
Yeah,
but
he's
being interviewed by a pretty low budget rendition of Brian Lunduk in puppet form. Watching this puppet looking in the opposite direction of him towards the camera, it's such an awkward set of social cues.
Exactly. I mean, it's genuinely disconcerting as a concept as it is.
Isn't it great?
Yeah.
I, by the way, I will be bringing my puppet to scale because I'm doing some other things with the puppet. Yeah, the puppet's got a whole bunch of interviews that are going to be happening at scale. So Mr. Lunduk, the puppet, will be at scale somewhere. So, yeah,
all right.
I'm just putting that out there.
Perhaps we can have it disemboweled on stage.
Yeah, maybe we can merge him into the show somehow.
Again, I would like to repeat, I am the absolute worst puppeteer that God ever invented. I am truly terrible. I kid you not. I was recording the very first video I did. I have these little poles that make you be able to move the hands around, the arms around. I can't use the hands of my puppet while simultaneously making the mouth move. So as soon as I started moving the hands around, I kept talking, but the mouth just stayed open like a retarded Pac-Man. And so I had to take the poles out just so that I could manage to move the mouth even somewhat close to the words I was actually saying. And even then, if you watch closely, there's at least two or three times per video where the puppet just keeps talking, but the mouth just stays slightly agape. So it's fantastic, really, is what I'm trying to say.
You know what would be funny? So Jeremy Stewart, you know what we could do? Wouldn't it be funny if we were to steal the puppet and somehow destroy it. So he has to go. He has to go cap in hand on a YouTube video saying, "Someone stole my puppet. I hate those guys."
No, I think no, John.
Hell no! I'm just going to put a paper bag on my hand and call it good.
I think that would be a terrible thing to do, and we should not. Do
yeah,
that
would be awful.
Definitely
we should not do that.
Do that.
You guys well, need you know, to stop we, nodding.
If,
yes.
If we were to do it, we'd get into trouble. Right,
but if for instance, say some bad Voltage fans who are listening
were to do it,
they could be assured that they would have the silent but enthusiastic support of at least 75% of the bad Voltage team.
At least, is there a possibility that it's a greater than 75% chance? Yeah, it would
be terrible. For example, if the puppet was to go missing and somehow appear on eBay, and then the puppet was purchased on eBay, and the sales from that puppet was maybe, I don't know, donated to Canonical.
You know,
for example.
while that is horrible sounding, if it does get kidnapped and there are ransom videos that start appearing on YouTube, now that I might be able to get behind.
It would also, for instance, be terrible if someone were to kidnap the puppet, fill it with barbecue sauce, and then give it back. As an example.
Actually, that...
This poor puppet, now I just feel bad.
This puppet is just getting violated. All right.
Rectally fed.
Do we have anything that doesn't involve destroying and disheartening a young puppet? Do we have any other topics? I don't think so. I think that's it, right?
I think we've said enough.
I think we have.
I think we... All right,
folks, we'll see you. We'll see you in Los Angeles for... Live Voltage, and if we don't see you there, well, you'll hear from us in Los Angeles on Live Voltage. Laters!